God has raised Jesus from the dead. That is what we are here to celebrate. That sin and evil and death have met their match. Jesus wins. This week, as I was preparing for my sermon this morning, I did what I always do. I try to figure out what passage I want to preach on early in the week. That way I can sit with the passage all week. And then what I do is I just read it. And I read it, and I read it. And I try to pay attention to the words or phrases or questions that emerge. And this week, as I was reading the gospel passage from John, because that's what I'm going to preach on, I kept coming back to the first verse, the beginning of the Easter story. John says this to us: "Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb." And it was that little detail, while it was still dark. This word about the darkness. And as I kept reading that verse, what struck me was the thought that John wants us to see that on that morning, it wasn't just dark outside because the sun hadn't risen yet, but this was also a time of darkness. And Mary carried that darkness within her. She carried the darkness of Good Friday, of seeing Jesus crucified, the darkness of losing one she loved, the one in whom she had placed her hope. And you see, what I think John is doing is he is telling us that we have to begin with the darkness if we want to understand this Easter story. We have to begin with the darkness of the world that we bear in our lives. I was recently reading a book, and in this book, the author was asking the question, how can we face the darkness of the world? Can we face it? What does that look like in our lives? And of course, this is a question that each one of us has to answer. The world is not completely dark, of course not. It's a world that is incredibly beautiful, full of joy and life and light. And yet we know that there is a darkness that is constantly trying to rob us of our joy. On Wednesday, we gathered as a church for a time of prayer, remembering the events at Covenant a year ago. That day a year ago was a day of darkness. A cancer diagnosis brings darkness. Our loss of our life, the loss of those we love, brings darkness. And so the question is, as we live our life in the face of darkness, how do we respond? Now in this book, what the writer does is he engages with a number of thinkers on this topic. And one thinker he engages with is Sigmund Freud, the great psychoanalyst. And what he argues is that Freud's approach to the darkness really represents modernity's approach, our culture's approach. Listen to what Freud has to say about the darkness of the world. He begins by saying that when we are truthful about the darkness we face, truthful about our reality, it makes us infinitely sad and terrified. And then Freud continues, this is a quote: "The real world is simply too dark, too terrible to admit. It tells man that he is a small, trembling animal who will decay and die. He is not important. He is not vital to the universe. He is not immortal in any way. The ache for cosmic specialness is irrational. It's madness. The yearning for glory, Freud says, is as uncritical and reflexive as the howling of a dog." And he says, therefore, in the face of the darkness of this world, we must shrink from being fully alive, both to the wonder and to the terror, and tranquilize ourselves with distractions so that we might live normal lives. So in Freud's mind, the darkness is just too great to face, and the only way to survive it is to distract yourself from it. And obviously, we know of a lot of distractions in our world today. But you see, the hope and the promise of Easter is that Freud is wrong. It's the hope that Jesus has faced the darkness for us. And more than that, he has entered into the darkness and come out on the other side. And so what I want to do this morning is I want us to look at this reading from John, John's account of Easter morning, and reflect on the promise and the hope that John gives us in this reading about the darkness and Jesus overcoming it. So, going back to the reading, we said that Mary makes her way to the tomb early in the morning. It's still dark outside. And as she gets to the tomb, we're told she sees that the stone is rolled away. And immediately she thinks grave robbers, which wasn't a bad assumption. Grave robbery in ancient Rome was a problem, despite several edicts from Rome forbidding the practice with some pretty stiff consequences. It continued. And that's because people were often buried with valuable things, right? Sentimental things like a ring or a necklace. So grave robbery was a problem. And so it's a reasonable assumption that that's what's happened here. So Mary sees this, and she runs to the disciples to tell them about it. Now, after she gives her report to them, we're told that Peter and the disciple whom Jesus loved, we assume this is the disciple John who wrote the gospel. So I'm just going to call him John in the sermon. When Peter and John hear this, they want to check it out for themselves. So they take off and they run to the tomb. Mary comes with them. Now, a point to make, the point is often made, but it's important. We have to remember that the disciples, they were not expecting a resurrection. Right? Mary and Peter and John, they were realists. They knew the power of death. They knew that when you died, it was final. So they go to the tomb expecting that it's been robbed. We're told that John gets there first. He's a little reluctant to go in. Peter shows up right behind him. Peter goes right into the tomb. When they get there, what they see is they see the cloth that was covering Jesus' face is at one end of the tomb, and the linens that Jesus' body was wrapped in, they're on the other end, wrapped up nicely. These little details were given. In this detail about the linens, it suggests to the reader that this was not the work of a thief. If someone was going to rob the tomb, they would either take the body or they would unwrap it. And if they did that, they definitely wouldn't stick around to clean up the crime scene and nicely stack the linens. So it doesn't seem to fit with a robbery. Now, John is looking at this situation, taking it all in, and we read this. He saw, John saw and believed, for as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. And that question has provoked, that verse has provoked a lot of questioning in the history of the church. You know, what is it that John believed, especially with that little disclaimer that the disciples don't understand the resurrection yet and the need for it? Some thinkers argue, well, what it means is that John here is believing Mary's testimony, right? Believing that the body is gone. But most say no, there's something else going on here. Most commentators believe that John sees in this situation the fingerprint of God. And though he doesn't understand it, he can't make sense of it yet, he believes that this is not a robbery, but rather this is mysteriously the work of God. Now, at this point, Peter and John, they've checked out the situation. They decide to go home. We assume that they invited Mary with them, but Mary decides to stay. She's not ready to leave this place that's associated with Jesus. And so she stands by the tomb, and as she stands there, she begins to weep. Again, the darkness. Now, as she weeps, we're told that she looks in the tomb, and she has a vision of two angels. At least that's how the other Gospels describe the event. It's some sort of vision. And these two angels ask her a question. Woman, why are you weeping? As if it's strange to be weeping in a cemetery. She then turns and she sees Jesus, but she doesn't recognize him. She thinks it's the gardener or the cemetery caretaker. There's something different about Jesus. And Jesus asks her the same question. Woman, why are you weeping? Jesus, of course, knows the answer, so he gives her a second question. Whom are you looking for? Mary, still thinking it's the caretaker of the cemetery, says, if you've moved the body, just tell me so that I can go and get it. And that's when Jesus speaks her name. He says, Mary. In the moment Mary hears her name from Jesus, she recognizes him for who he is. Now, we got to stop here because this encounter, this exchange is important about Jesus speaking her name. If we remember back in chapter 10 of John's Gospel, there Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. I am the one who leads and guides and protects my sheep. I search them out for them when they're lost, and I bring them home. And he says, I know the name of each sheep. Each sheep has a name. And when I call out the name of that sheep, they recognize me. They recognize me as the shepherd. And so here with Jesus and Mary, we have the shepherd and the sheep. And I think this encounter is so important because it reveals to us that the resurrection is so personal. On Easter, we talk about the fact that sin and evil and death have been overcome, which are powerful ideas. But often, it can sound abstract, and we can wonder, what does this mean for us? But what it does mean is that because Jesus has overcome the darkness that keeps us from God, because of this, each individual is to be redeemed, to be consoled, to be comforted. Each individual is to be brought into this intimate relationship with Jesus and the Father, to be cared for, protected, and watched over by the Good Shepherd who knows each one of us by name. There's a song, you may have heard of it. It's called, I Come to the Garden Alone. I don't think we've ever sung it here in the table. It's kind of a sentimental song. Baptists sing those kind of songs, not us. But it's a good song. And I can remember being in Murfreesboro, where I served before coming to St. George's, And I visited a woman a number of times. She was older. She was in hospice care. And she loved this song. And she always had it playing. And there was one verse that she loved. And the verse goes like this. And he walks with me, and he talks to me, and he tells me I am his own. Right? You are his own because of what he has done. Now, when this happens, when Mary recognizes Jesus, what she does is something we would probably all do. She runs to him and she throws her arms around him and gives him a hug, holds him. And then Jesus says to her, he says, Mary, do not hold on to me because I have not yet ascended to the Father. Some translations say, don't cling to me, Mary, because I haven't ascended. Again, a verse that the church has wrestled with over the years in terms of what does it mean? What is Jesus saying? Most scholars, they argue that this holding on to Jesus, this clinging, was an attempt to get back to how things were before Good Friday. And Jesus is saying, we can't go back. Things have changed. But many say there is something more here as well. When John writes his gospel, he tells the story of the Son of God who descends into creation and then ascends back to the Father. So in the beginning of John's gospel, we're told that the Son of God, who was one with the Father, the Word who was with God, the Word who was God, he comes down and he descends. He lives among us. He pitches his tent in our neighborhood. And then he goes all the way down, even into death itself, as we've said, all the way into the darkness. But of course, the darkness cannot hold him. And so he comes back up. He is resurrected. And then he ascends to the Father. It's as if Jesus was a diver who dove deep into the ocean to get the pearls that are stuck in the muck at the bottom, to bring them back into the sunlight. And why does he do this? Well, he does this to bring us back into relationship with God so that he might lead us into a new type of relationship, just as the beginning of John's gospel says, so that we might become children of God. God's children. And that's, of course, what we hear in the next verse. Jesus says to Mary, Mary, go and say to my brothers, which is an intimate term, say to my brothers that I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and to your God. Now here we are very close to the heart of John's proclamation. This language of my Father and your Father, my God and your God. The word Father is used 120 times in the Gospel of John. This is the only time it refers to us. Every other time the word Father is used, it's used to describe Jesus' relationship with God. God is Jesus' Father. But here Jesus says, because of what he has done, because he has entered into the darkness to lift us out of it, because of this, a new possibility is born. And that is, God might be our Father. Jesus went down into the darkness that holds us, into pain, into suffering, into death itself, to bring us and all of creation back to God. I am ascending to my Father and your Father, my God and your God. Rowan Williams, the previous Archbishop of Canterbury, he says that when we stand in the center of Easter, we are standing in the center of the second Big Bang. We all know about the first Big Bang. It created everything around us, space, time, all living things. And you see, the second Big Bang, it creates something new as well. It creates a new possibility, a new future for us, a future in which God's love for us and his love for the world wins rather than the darkness. And what that means, again, is it means that Freud was wrong. We don't have to shrink from being fully alive in the face of darkness. We don't have to tranquilize ourselves with distractions. The darkness is strong, to be sure, but the love of God is stronger. And so we turn to God and we put our trust and our faith in the resurrected Jesus, the one who says to us, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." We do this as God's children. Christ is risen. Amen.